in this case, it's been such a good thing. And I've been given the space to really kind of want to go over a line again because there aren't any lips to match it to. And also gives the opportunity for the writers to finesse the dialogue, to create more tension.
Welcome to the Dagobah Dispatch, where a bunch of nerds nerd out on nerdy stuff, specifically nerdy Star Wars stuff. And this week we are going to break down Chapter 19 of The Mandalorian, also known as The Convert, also known as Season 3, Episode 3. Is Dr. Pershing perishing? Wordplay. We will get into it. Plus, we will welcome this week's guest, a guy who goes by the name of Pedro Pascal. He goes by that name because he is Pedro Pascal. Funny how that works. It's a big show this week with a big guest and a big episode of The Mandalorian. And a new Star Wars movie just came out. We will explain. I am Dalton Ross, joined by Devin Gogan and Lauren Morgan, who made me look really bad by going into the office today after I said I couldn't make it in due to train issues. Lauren, why you got to do me like that?
I was already in the office by the time you had the train issues. I was in the office at 7:50 in the morning, so I was already there. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to start work at 8, so.
She threw me under the bus so hard. Like, I'm in the New York City. We have a Slack channel for all of us in EW in the New York office. And so there's always, like, on Tuesday, it's like, hey, who's going in tomorrow, this, that. So I went over to my train station and I bundled up, put on all my winter gear. It's super windy.
Yeah, it is very, it's not
in the dirty jurors. It's super gnarly. So I bundled up, I'm out there waiting for the train. They make the announcement it's canceled. I go home, they've canceled all these other trains from my town.
Oh, dang.
So I go into the New York City Slack channel and I'm like, hey guys, looks like I can't make it. I even like include a message, like the email from New Jersey Transit, so they don't think I'm just faking it, Mr. Phony Baloney over here. I do all that. The next message is from Lauren in the Slack channel. Keep in mind, she lives in the town right next to me, and Lauren's like, I'm here.
Wow.
I wasn't really trying to burn Dalton. I was basically just telling people like, well, I'm already here if you want to come in. So, because I've been here since 7:50 in the morning. So, but I take God the pass train. I don't depend on New Jersey Transit. So
that is
different
nice.
Train
that
systems is nice. Oh, for I'm people who are not New Jersey people. That makes no sense whatsoever. But yeah, it's a different train.
It was all about like the timing too, because I was like, all right, Devin's like this episode of Mandalorian comes out at like midnight West Coast time, 3 a.m. East Coast. So Devin's like, all right, look, I'll stay up and I'll write it up. And I'm like, great. And I'll get up early and I'll edit and get it live. So it's all just doing the math because you don't know how long the episode is.
Yeah.
Right.
So I was like, all right, I'll get up at 6 a.m. because these episodes are usually like 40 minutes. Sometimes they're like 32 minutes. Sometimes they're like 46. But that's really the range you're looking at. I turn on the old Disney Plus and it's like 58 minutes, it says the episode is. I'm like, oh, this is going to be tight. This is going to be tight. And so I like quickly had to like get through. I'm like eating my Lego waffles like while I'm like watching the episode. It was a whole thing.
So. Not Mandalorian waffles?
I know. I didn't have the Grogu or Mandalorian the Grogu waffles, unfortunately. Tracker. I didn't order those from the Disney store. Real quickly, we're going to get in hardcore to the Mandalorian new episode. And we got Pedro Pascal joining
Exciting.
Us a little bit. It's not too slouchy. But real quickly, I want to hit on something that ended up in our Dagobah Dispatch Slack channel this week that a new Star Wars movie just premiered. That is a completely accurate statement. Now, it's not, it's a movie about Star Wars. It's not.
It is a documentary.
Episode 10 just came out. You guys didn't hear that?
A surprise release. You know, Lucasfilm kept it real quiet. But no.
Yeah, it's a documentary called, great title, A Disturbance in the Force. It's from Jeremy Kuhn and Steve Kozak. And it's basically a documentary on the Star Wars holiday special. And I'll just give ourselves a plug, because if you're new to the podcast or you missed it, back in December, we did our whole breakdown on the Star Wars holiday special. So everyone should go back and check that out because we had an absolute blast doing it. Well, this is a whole documentary on it that just debuted at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. Apparently, guys, it's, you know, none of the original Star Wars cast is in this. None of the big, most of the guest stars aren't in it because unfortunately they're no longer with us. But it does have a, it does have the Steve Binder, who's the director, so the replacement director came in. A few of the writers, including Bruce Vilanch, is in this. Apparently, one of the guys from Jefferson Starship shows up in this. I think Bob Mackie, who did the costumes, is in this. And then they have a lot of like archival interviews with cast and guest stars. And then like your typical kind of modern day talking heads, you know, Kevin Smith's in it, Seth Green's in it. Weird Al apparently is in it.
Incredible.
So yeah, it's come out at South by Southwest. I don't know when it's going to go out wider or be available, but Devin, how much are you looking forward to seeing this? A Disturbance in the Force.
Look, I am very excited to watch this, if only because it'll give me like the taste of watching the holiday special without having to actually watch it again. but no, I think this is so fun. And like, this is the thing where I think we had this reaction, and I think most people have this reaction when they watch the holiday special, which is, how did this get made? And so here's a documentary that attempts to answer that very question. But yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And like, I don't know. It's just, I can't imagine. It's just fascinating to me that this exists in the era where Star Wars is like so locked down and so image conscious, and everything has to be a tie-in to everything else, and everything. There are whole people whose just their jobs it is to make it everything, you know, like make the continuity and everything. And so to have something as beautiful and weird as the Star Wars holiday special and have a whole documentary about it, I love it. I love it. I'm so
there's also other weird stuff from that era. Like, and I guess Donny Osmond's in this documentary. He talks about the Donnie and Marie Star Wars episode, which is insane.
An insane sentence.
And then when Mark Hamill and C-3PO and R2 were on the Muppet Show, like there's just a lot of weird 70s Star Wars content that, you know, next time we're in between Disney Plus streaming shows, I feel, Lauren, that we're going to have to hit up in depth as well.
Mm-hmm. I would.
Is that a threat or a promise?
Our listeners are like, oh God, not again. You know,
maybe we need to do like another rewatch of the Ewok films, just in case our opinions have changed, and in case anyone has gotten hold of the power.
The power.
I think what we needed to ask Pedro Pascal about was his love of the Ewok, since he professed that he is Team Ewok. So. You know, next time we get him. That's
if Lauren did that interview, it would have been all Ewoks.
I would have just talked to him about Return of the Jedi and why it's his favorite. You know, screw the Mandalorian. We're just going to talk about Return of the Jedi.
You might as well with some of these interviews, because like they're not really going to say anything.
They can't say anything, so we might as well be like, you know,
yeah.
Who's your favorite Ewok?
Well, we do have some fun. We do have some fun with Pedro Pascal in a little bit, so you're going to get to hear that. But we can now talk freely about Mandalorian, Chapter 19. Which just aired, a pretty fascinating episode. And just to give the real super brief quick recap, because I'm guessing most of you guys saw it. Basically, it's bookended with Mando and Bo-Katan, and we could talk about them a little bit, but not a lot there. Like, it's basically weird bookends, and I want to ask you guys how you felt about that. But the heart of the episode is basically going to Coruscant and seeing Dr. Pershing. He was the guy working on trying to, like, you know, take Grogu's blood and work on this cloning program, but always seemed to actually did seem to care about Grogu, even as he was doing these experiments. So it didn't seem like a total heel. We pick up with him on Coruscant, and he's part of this like amnesty program, which is basically taking Imperial officers and sort of reintegrating them into the New Republic. But there are some restrictions kind of on where they can go and what they can do as they sort of get their feet back on the good side of things. And basically, Dr. Pershing is then living in this sort of amnesty housing. And he comes across, I think it's Aliyah Kane, I believe is her name. Mm-hmm. Hope I'm pronouncing that right.
But he just knows her as like, what is she, like G62, or they all just refer to each other as their as numbers, yeah, which as is like numbers. Weird and dehumanizing, but okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like she's basically was a communications officer that we saw in season two working for Moff Gideon. And so she basically like, you know, she befriends him. They become friends. He's getting frustrated because, well, he wants to be on the right side of things. He also wants to continue his cloning because he mentions his mom died and had this cloning technology been around, it could have saved her. And he thinks it's really for the best that they keep researching this, but he's not allowed to. So she basically convinces him, hey, they've got that equipment you need on an old Star Destroyer. Now let's sneak off campus and jump off a metro rail and basically go in there and take it so you can continue doing this for the good. So they get the stuff. Then, of course, he's immediately surrounded by New Republic guards. And she basically takes the equipment and zaps his brain. Now, that's sort of the basic gist of it. And I guess I want to start here. Did either of you buy for a single second that Aliyah Kane was not setting Pershing up this entire episode, Devin?
Oh, 1,000%. Like literally she had like blinking neon signs on her forehead that was like, I'm going to backstab you. It was just like, she just read the Gaslighter's playbook and just followed it step by step. I mean, it was really, it was really kind of masterful. I mean, look, I get it. You know, for a man, he used to work for Werner Herzog, who I don't think was a very kind boss. And so here's like a nice person who's like, I think you're really smart and like you should do some good in the world. And he's like, yeah, I think I should. But also I love the moment where they're like getting ready to go on this mission and find this, you know, technology. And he like looks himself in the mirror and is like, you're doing the right thing. You're doing good. And like this really ominous music starts playing. And I'm like, I think you're probably not though. If that's the musical cue that's happening, and you have to literally convince yourself that you're doing the right thing. No, but I, you know, this was such a fascinating episode, you know, especially because like for a show called The Mandalorian was barely in it. And it's interesting to see Coruscant for the, you know, this is sort of like the first time we've seen it in the New Republic era. And sort of, you know, you get this idea that not much has changed, you know, sort of we see that scene at the very beginning of the episode with sort of the wealthy elite on Coruscant. And they're very much like Empire, you know, New Republic, who cares? My life hasn't changed, which is a little, you know, accurate for, you know, most people who live under, you know, regime changes. I thought it was kind of really fascinating, this idea of, okay, like, what do you do with the, you know, Imperial officers that have been, you know, living? So I don't know. I was just kind of fast. This episode was not what I expected when I turned on my television. So it was kind of an interesting ride.
Yeah, I like that unexpectedness, and I like sort of going a deep dive on Coruscant. I actually don't even know if we needed the bookends, and we can talk a little bit about that as well. But Lauren, just sort of general big picture, what'd you think of the episode?
I really thought the Coruscant stuff was interesting because, like as Devin mentioned, like we really haven't seen Coruscant in the New Republic era. On any of like sort of live action stuff or really even the animated stuff. And it was, and Devin mentioned this in her postmortem, it was, gave me kind of almost like an Andor. It felt like the most like Andor that the Mandalorian has ever felt like. And I was like, when Dr. Pershing was just, you know, working in his New Republic thing, and I was just like, I was expecting like Cyril Karn and Deidre to be,
yes,
like in the background. Like, I know they're not going to reveal what happens to them because we haven't seen the second season, but I was just like, I would not be surprised if Cyril Karn was in one of these cubicles also.
Oh, 1,000%.
They should have just put some cereal in his cube. Yeah, like, that's what they should have done.
But like, this person just keeps leaving the cereal around here. What's going on? But yeah, as you know, I thought that stuff was really interesting. Also, it was very obvious that he was being completely set up, but it was interesting to see that Pershing was just trying to do his work, like as a scientist, and, you know, maybe he wasn't gung ho on the Empire, but he was trying to do, you know, so you just kind of see all these kind of people who got caught up in the Empire as well. Whereas, you know, Aliyah just seems a little, I'm like kind of curious about, like, you know, when she kind of gave him the super mind flay at the end, like, you know, is this, you know, one of Moff Gideon's true believers? And is she, you know, when the new order, the first order sort of starts sparking up, is she gonna, you know, run back to that and sort of stuff like that. But I thought that was pretty interesting. So,
here's I got a few questions. Mm-hmm. Here's my first question. I don't mean to be a big Dumbo and not understand things, right? But like, why? So she brings him to the Super Star Destroyer.
Yeah.
They steal the equipment. All of a sudden, the sirens go off. The New Republic guards catch them. Why do those guards let her walk away with the cloning tech? Can anyone explain that to me? She they got all their guns pointed on Pershing, and she's like, I'll take that, and just walks right past them all.
It was she was trying to get like the right cloning stuff so she could just pass it off to whoever, you know, the people who are actually doing the cloning stuff are doing it right now. I don't know.
But I don't understand. They catch these two people. Yeah.
Well, no, I think the suggestion is like, that she ratted him out.
Yeah, like, she basically was just like, yeah, I've got this guy. He's obviously about to, you know, do something against the New Republic. You guys just come and catch us here. And I'll
but they let her take
you.
The cloning tech, apparently.
Like, I'm sure she was like, I'm going to take this to the evidence locker. Yeah, and they were like, absolutely.
Sure.
Seems like a lot of trust to give to a former Imperial Commission.
Maybe these people are former stormtroopers that have been indoctrinated back into the program. Like,
they were just
who knows?
Like, yep, okay.
Yeah.
No, but I was also fascinated by like, okay, so you just need the cloning tech. You don't need the actual doctor.
Yeah.
Why can't you just go get it yourself?
Like, yeah. Right. No, totally. And so. All right, that's just part one of the question.
Yeah.
Why are they leaving then, at the end of the episode, this former Imperial officer alone right by the controls to the H602 mitigator? you want to stay here? Sure, no problem. And they just walk out.
You think there would be like a lock on that? Like, okay, we're just going to mind flay you for this. And because you can't even change there's certain things you can't change at like a toaster oven sometimes when you've set it in motion. So you'd think they'd have like a lock, like it's not going past this. But
why is she even overseeing the procedure to begin? How does she get in there? I thought these amnesty people had like very strict limits. She's in the room and then the dude just leaves the room and leaves her in there just to turn it to Max.
We're seeing the New Republic wasn't as competent as we thought it was.
I think we're getting the sense that like I was very much like, you know, when I watched the sequel trilogy, I was like, really already? Like the First Order is like rising already and like the New Republic has collapsed. And now watching these couple episodes, I'm like, oh, the New Republic collapsed because they're all a bunch of dumb idiots. Like, they're not good at their job.
Well, that was like one I think that I was thinking about the novel Bloodline, which Dalton and I talk about a lot, where I was like, you kind of see how the New Republic started to like sort of fall to the First Order. It was just because like they kind of had gotten so mired in bureaucracy that they kind of couldn't see, you know, they couldn't see the forest for the trees. Yeah, pretty much. They, you know, they couldn't see the forest for the trees, and they made the sort of the same mistake. The one thing I did think was interesting was because I know we've had a time jump between seasons 2 and 3, and this was where I really sort of like this sort of amnesty program, because the last time we saw Pershing, he was, you know, working with like kind of, you know, Moff Gideon and like that whole thing. And then you're like, oh, it's been 2 years for him. So yeah, I could understand like he's been caught and he's been, you know, that was sort of the thing where I was just like, hold on, you were just on a ship. And like, at least knowing that there has been a gap of a couple of years. And so everyone on Moff Gideon's ship has gotten put into the amnesty program, you know. But I really have to say that droid needs some like better, the parole droid that was asking the questions, like they need some better sensory tech going on there. Like whatever they used in Blade Runner to sense if it was a replicant or not, they needed something where you could tell if it was like they had Imperial sympathies or something.
Yeah, this entire episode gave me very strong Blade Runner vibes, which you know, Coruscant has always had a very, you know, Blade Runner vibe, but this episode particularly. And I don't know. I loved the idea of like the space subway just being like a literal subway train, except it flies through space.
Yep. What do we think about Pershing at the end? Is this dude just, is he dead? Is he a vegetable? Is he like kind of like Bodhi in Rogue One now, where he's just kind of very confused? Like, What's the end result?
I thought it was probably going to be a little bit like Bix Killeen, because they weren't they using the mind flayer on her in Andor? Like, I just thought, like, you know, yeah, their mind's going to be, his mind's going to be a little bit scrambled. And you would think if they're still trying to do cloning technology, you don't want to scramble the mind of your cloning scientist. But alas, you know, maybe Kane's not thinking about that right now.
She just got the tech and was like, okay, bye. Yeah. You know, we're gonna turn him into a vegetable.
It's very lax security in the New Republic. Yeah. It seems very lax.
Yeah, they're all very trusting, and they're very much like, yeah, not necessarily what they need to be.
Yeah.
So what, anything you guys thought else about Coruscant? Because like we said, it's the first time we've really seen it in this era. And it, you know, I didn't notice any thing hugely different from what we've seen before, either in animated form or prequels, or that one quick snippet in the special edition of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's interesting to see that, you know, Coruscant does not look like it has suffered that much through the intergalactic war between the Rebels and the Empire. And I thought it was really interesting to see that the rich, basically, like, they were exactly the same as they were in Andor under the Empire. They were like, I don't really care. Like, you know, this isn't affecting me at all. Who cares? And we kind of see that in the sequel trilogy, too, on Canto Bight, where everyone's just like, whatever, you know. And so at least the rich are consistent across the Star Wars timelines. They're very much, like, apathetic. So
this is true.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about the fact that this episode was bookended with the Mando and Bo-Katan stuff. What'd you all think about that? I almost thought it was very unnecessary, and it's weird, yeah, because we sort of did talk about, well, why in the Book of Boba Fett all of a sudden are you doing like a whole Mandalorian episode? But it sort of feels like these were characters that have been part of the Mandalorian world, and let's check in on them for a full episode. It's almost like Disney Plus was like scared to put out a Mandalorian episode without a shot of Mando and Grogu.
Yeah.
And Grogu, right? Like, they know these Lauren Morgans out there need their Grogu fix every single week.
I would have actually just been fine. And I think it would have been a very interesting episode if it was just on Coruscant. And
yeah, me
because
too.
I thought like the way they did it was like super distracting. And I'm like, could you guys have just not padded out the Mandalorian stuff and made that one episode? And like, cause it, like the Coruscant episode felt like pretty much a full episode of material. So I just didn't think that like I thought the Mandalorian stuff was interesting, but it should have been its own episode.
Why? Yeah, that's a good point, Lauren. Like, yeah, the last week's episode was not that long. They literally could have, I guess they wanted the cliffhanger in quotes with the mythosaur. Right, yeah. Right. But they could have started the next episode then, right where, you know, where that, mm-hmm, one left off. They didn't need to put this stuff in there. Devin, what did you make of them throwing this stuff in with Coruscant?
I felt the same way. I would have liked this to be a standalone episode focusing just on Dr. Pershing, especially because, like, tonally, that's kind of what it was, except for these weird little bookends. You know, the bits with Mando and Bo-Katan were interesting. They weren't, like, my favorite. There was a couple moments this week where I was just like, oof, that's just, like, a little – they're, like, in the ship fighting the TIE bombers and, like – Just some of the dialogue was a little like, we got company. Like, it was just like a very, yeah, kind of standard, you know.
Watch your six.
Exactly. Yeah. Like somebody writing Star Wars fan fiction. But like, I liked the stuff with Bo-Katan sort of like finding this, you know, sort of like coming to the covert and being like, oh, there's all these Mandalorians who like love Mandalore as much as I do. And like how nice it is to be a part of this sort of like family when, you know, we've seen her in the last couple episodes, just her being extremely alone. So for her to be surrounded by, you know, fellow Mandalorians, you could tell like she sort of warmed up to this, even though she's sort of like denounced the Children of the Watch as like this cult and she, you know, they're old fashioned and blah, blah, blah. I'm sure it's going to blow up in everyone's face in the next, mm-hmm, you know, couple episodes. She's going to remove her helmet or get upset about some kind of, you know, or she's going to transgress some, you know, some unwritten rule and, you know, there's going to be a big blow up, at some point. But it's kind of interesting to see her sort of like be welcomed into this, you know, this group. And, you know, certainly after her encounter with the Mythosaur, I think she's a little more willing to believe in some of the superstition-y stuff. There was also a moment I wanted to point out where, I think it's near the beginning of the episode and they're all flying together. And, you know, they both, Bo-Katan and Din both say, this is the way. And we hear Grogu kind of go, like in the background, yeah. like does a little babble. And they both kind of like turn and look at him. And it's a very much like a moment. I'm like, oh, they're forecasting his, he's going to say this is the way at some point this season. So again, I'm still on baby Grogu, first words first watch. Word. So
yeah,
this was an episode that sort of, you know, the alarm bells went off for me for that.
I was thinking that too, Devin. I was thinking about you when Grogu said that little pip there.
Yeah.
So spoiler alert, we are supposed to have Katie Sackhoff on our show next week and we will ask her this, but Lauren, what did you make of Bo not telling Mando or the armor around the Mythosaur? She kind of dances around it with Mando. She's like, hey, by the way, when you were underwater, did you see anything?
Which you would think if Din was paying attention, or maybe like, you know, maybe Din's just sort of was like still recovering, but you'd think he'd be like, why? What did you see? But like Din's just not even thinking, you know. But I thought that was really interesting. That also
brings, Lauren, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that also brings up the point. If he's like, no, I didn't see, there's nothing down there. How did he end up at the bottom? I assumed he got pulled to the bottom.
Yeah, I assume he got pulled, but it just sounded like there, like it's, I guess it was supposed to be sort of like a shallow lake, but Bo was saying that, like, you know, the whatever the fissures or the bombs or the earthquakes made it like sort of a cavern, like or a culvert that he fell down in, I guess. Because
you can feel yourself falling, and then you just like hit your jetpack.
It seemed like he kind of got like knocked out. Like it seemed to me he was knocked out when he went down. And maybe just because
maybe
of
doesn't remember
the pressure. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, but to me, it seemed like he was completely out of commission when she got him. So
I kind of love this because I also thought after last week, like, oh, he got pulled down by something. It was a trash compactor moment. Something grabbed his leg.
Yeah.
No, I like the idea that this dummy just walked into a lake wearing a full set of armor. And then as soon as he sank like a rock, like I love the idea that he wasn't like, you know, like, hey, maybe I should like, I don't know, be careful seeing as I'm wearing like literal weights around my entire body. I mean, like, I agree with you. I think it's kind of like unclear narratively, but I love the idea that he was just a big dummy and was like, sure, I'm going to wade into this lake wearing the literal, you know, weights on my body. And just as soon as he hit like a deep spot, he just went, boom, he sank like a rock. Because if there's one thing I'm realizing about Din after three seasons of this show is that he is just a big dummy. He is just a big heart of gold, like does not always think things through. Just not all the brain cells are firing for our boy Din Djarin. And I love that about him.
Din's a little dim. So Lauren, why is Bo-Katan not telling him about this Mythosaur? Is it because she's like, now everything that she's thought was false is now true and she doesn't know what to make of it?
I feel like she's just trying to play the long game where I'm just going to hold this little piece of information for myself because, you know, this is the thing where I think between Din and Bo is that Din does not want to be the leader of Mandalore. He has no interest in whatsoever. He wants to take care of his little green son and he wants to be part of his covert, and that's like pretty much kind of it for him. But Bo-Katan's always thinking about the long-term thing. So I think she's just kind of like, I'm just going to keep this little piece of knowledge in my pocket for some other reason. But I am definitely going to ask Katie about this tomorrow when I talk to her, because I am very curious. When I saw that, I was like, oh, that's interesting. She's not being, you know, for all of her saying that, you know, she's so tired of the conflict between the various Mandalorian clans and things like that. She's still kind of to stir the pot. She's not really willing to be completely open about things yet. So kind of interesting.
Well, if she wants to stir the pot, how long is she going to keep that helmet on then?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, but I don't know.
Well, I will say this: like, I could like in the whole first early scenes. Mm-hmm. When they had those TIE bombers that were attacking them and then all of a sudden just like blew up her castle. Like I could feel it in the writing room. Like I could feel them saying, all right, how are we going to get her off Kalevala? Like we just got like, let's just have a bunch of rando Imperials for no reason.
Yeah, I was just like,
swoop in, bomb her castle and leave. And then she's got to go. Like that just like, there's, I'm like, what's the story?
I'm like, is the New Republic just not kind of scanning the Mandalore system at all? Like, what's, like, you know, where's Captain Teva? Like, is any of their, like, X-Wing pilots, like, scanning this system? Because that is a large contingent of TIE fighters or TIE interceptors that they fell off, you know? So I'm just sort of like, yeah, it's good. I can kind of see how the First Order, you guys aren't really keeping a tight clamp on this right now, so...
Look, yeah. They're understaffed. They are, yeah. You know, they're overworked. Underpaid. It's hard. It's hard to be a New Republic pilot, apparently, which is how you end up with, yeah, like this. My other question is, was there anybody else in that castle, or was it just like Bo hanging out by herself droid?
What was their mission? Like, what was going? Why were they attacking that place at that time? Like, there's no real reasoning.
She talks about how she's like gotten on the wrong side of some Imperial
warlords,
you know, mud scuffers, and you know, basically, I'm sure they were like, yeah, we're gonna do a run on Calavella and blow up Bo-Katan's castle while she's still
and
in
also,
it.
The other thing I have to say about Calavella, I'm like, that looks like a pretty nice planet. Like, I know Mandalore is kind of a wreck right now, but its moons seemed fully inhabitable, guys. Like, you know, if the Alderaan people have come together to organize themselves and they don't even have a planet or anything, maybe you guys can just figure out something on one of these moons here. Like, come on. Like, what are you guys doing? That's, you know, that was my other thing. I'm like, this seems like a very nicely inhabitable planet right now. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The only last thing I'll say about this episode is I did love the super mustache twirling moment when Elia Kane turns like the mind flare thing to maximum and then just eats the yellow biscuit.
So good. It was like the evil version of the Ted Lasso biscuits.
Yeah.
And like I also so evil. And I loved when they're like they go to this festival and they have these light up popsicles.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
like, man, they are gonna sell those at Galaxy's Edge within 6 months. Guarantee. Yep.
Yep. I think by next week, probably.
Yeah, they probably timed it. They're probably
getting
them now.
They'll probably be like, you know, see these next week. So
I did like that they were like, look, this is the top of the mountain in Coruscant.
Oh, that I actually did think that was interesting because that has appeared in other Star Wars novels. Like, I think it was like, so like when they were like, oh, it's the peak of Umante, because like that was in one of the High Republic novels, and it was also in a couple of the other novels. So when they said that, I was like, oh, that's what that looks like. I could never quite picture what that was. So
I don't know how you remember this stuff, Laura. I've read literally hundreds of Star Wars books. I don't remember anything. Like, after I read them, I'm just like, huh, what? Who is that character? What
the thing
mountain?
Is,
like,
I can't remember.
I've read those High Republic books. I don't remember
I had for dinner last night. I can't remember certain things at all. Like, if you ask me what dialogue I said like 30 minutes ago, no idea, but I remember random facts from books and things like that.
So let me ask you a question then. Yeah. What kind of sweater are you wearing now? Wild or crazy?
This is wild, and I specifically picked this one because I was like, well, I have to wear a wild sweater because you told me my sweater last week was not wild. So
all right, there you go.
See, at least like we've had that discussion, so now I remember that I said
now
wild.
You remember. All right, good enough. Mm-hmm. All right, anything else you guys want to hit on with this episode? No?
Nothing, just that I want to try some of those biscuits.
I know. Mm-hmm. Let's get some of those going on. All right. Since we're talking about The Mandalorian, how about we talk to The Mandalorian? I had a chance to catch up with Pedro Pascal himself, and we'll play that chat right after this quick break.
Also,
knowing more about Jelko.
When the fourth round would...
Don't you call in the...
Don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on The Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with The Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at ew.com/awardist.
It's So obviously all of us Star Wars nerds would be killing to be doing what you're doing. So just tell me about your favorite day on set you've ever had on The Mandalorian from any season and just what made it so awesome.
There's so many days to pick from, because when you think about the visual experience that audiences have when they watch the show, it's hard to imagine that you would get such a clear impression of how sophisticated those visuals are on the day when you're shooting it. But you can't imagine, for example, the first episode of season two when we meet this really amazing Blade Runner-esque urban environment. I can't think of a time in Star Wars where you felt like you were in a real, like, city. And we have this immaculate set that's built and surrounded by the volume, which creates, you know, an infinite sort of visual experience as far as skies, planets, and landscapes are concerned, and space and ships and all kinds of things. But the practical set was the most immaculate, down to it being graffitied and decorated. Every inch of it was designed. So to step onto set, and it's not even the only one that felt like that. The snow-capped world was also, you know, completely detailed. It just felt like you were stepping onto these highly sophisticated amusement park rides in a way, very little being left to the imagination, because of how incredible the design work is from all the departments.
It's amazing watching the show, but I get a little stressed out watching it, because I see you in that suit, that armor. It can't be super comfortable, but I feel like the going to the bathroom situation would really stress me out. Like, because I imagine you'd have to stay hydrated in that thing, but then I also imagine it's not easy. How do you manage that exactly?
There's access. It's not a one piece suit. He's wearing pants, and you know, there's such incredible work that's done by Brendan Wayne and by Latif Crowder and even others that step into the suit at this point. It's such a collective effort, and the suit ends up doing so much of the work, you know, in terms of how badass you look when you put it on. You know, it's impossible not to look cool when you're wearing it. And that's very helpful, to be honest with you.
Is that something you think about, like just the economy of movement? Like, I don't need to move a lot. He's a very still character, as we know. So yeah, in terms of thinking the way you move in it.
It's a fascinating challenge, because you don't want to do too little and then too much can go too far. We were always worried that it could be a little bobbleheady if you're kind of like, you know, talking and moving your head. So there's been such sort of surgical work done in terms of creating the right portrayal, which also has so much to do with the vocal work as well. And it's been this kind of fascinating collaboration with John and Dave Filoni from the beginning. And I can get a little OCD, you know, I can get a little, give me the opportunity to kind of really focus on details. And in this case, it's been such a good thing. And I've been given the space to really kind of want to go over a line again, because there aren't any lips to match it to. And also gives the opportunity for the writers to finesse the dialogue, to create more tension. It's really cool. And also, I guess in other roles, I've never been able to see it so early as far as all of the post is concerned, which on a show like this is so elaborate that it's amazing to kind of start, be in a booth with John and with Dave and see stick figure drawings. It's never stick figure drawings, because they're always sort of brilliant from the start, but something that is basically suggesting and visually so pedestrian in terms of what it's going to become. And to get to see the process in that regard has been really fascinating.
That's awesome. Do any of your friends, like, you guys have had such great cameos and guest stars. Do any of your friends bug you for cameos, even if it's like being under Mandalorian or Stormtrooper armor? Cause dude, if we were closer, I'd be hitting you up for that like every day.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't had any friends try to get me to get them cast on the show. but I know that John has had a lot of different people come in and artists that love the world of Star Wars, that love the show, that have gotten to come in and either have something, a significant role in an episode or, a multi-episode arc, or just an extra, you know, sitting in the crowd. And so it's a kind of like a fun thing to share with people that love it.
I'm a classic TV fan. Like I loved a good crossover, like Love Boat Fantasy Island style, like on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
So how do you think Grogu and Ellie from The Last of Us would get along if we had like the buddy road trip show with those two? How do you think that would go?
Well, Fantasy Island and the Love Boat, there was like the same planet, right?
Or, yeah, that's true.
Same timeline. So it's impossible.
Fantasy Island had some like mystical, weird stuff going on there. You know, there's some magic happening.
Where was the island?
We don't know. That's just it.
Really? It was just Fantasy Island?
Yeah.
We don't have any fantasies on The Mandalorian or The Last of Us, but I feel like they would, you know, walk off into the sunset together, to be honest with you.
In a good way, I guess, right?
They'd be best friends.
If you had to pick a Mandalorian castmate of yours, the actor, not the character, to protect Grogu, who would get the job? And why?
One of the things I'm most excited about is Bo-Katan in season 3. So I'd have to hand it over to Katie Sackhoff. If anything, I trust her more than I trust myself.
Pedro, man, thanks for the time. I really appreciate it. And have a good one.
You too.
Thanks to Pedro Pascal for hanging out with us this week. And thank you for hanging out as well. We really do appreciate it. And we would also appreciate it if you could please follow and rate and review the podcast. That would be super nice of you. We like it when nice people do nice things. You can connect with us on social media by following Entertainment Weekly on all socials. It's at EW on Twitter and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag and follow us directly using at Dalton Ross, at Devin Kogan, and at Morg Lore. Thanks so much, everyone. We'll do it all over again next week.
This episode of Dagobah Dispatch is hosted by Dalton Ross, Devin Kogan, and Lauren Morgan. Produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio. Edited by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.